The pop culture show presented by Luna Nuda Prosecco. Cheers with Luna Nuda. The year is almost over. We're your pop culture show, the pop culture show. What we are is a deep dive into the latest celebrity news, music, TV, technology. We throw in a lot of observations of the crazy world around us. We're your hosts, Barnes, Leslie, and Cubby, one more time in 2020. And this episode will be our favorite interviews of 2020. A lot of people we've picked up. Cubby, you mentioned last week a lot of growth over the last couple of months. Some people may not even know what, you know, this show came about because of the pandemic.
It did. We just came together just to have some fun, and it turned into something really cool.
And you guys have that long 99X history, and I've known you guys just as friends since the early 90s. So it was meant to be, guys. Group hug. Oh, wait, we can't.
Group hug. It's just strange how when this whole thing started out, it was Barnes, Leslie, and Jimmy, which was our morning show. And we knew from the beginning that Jimmy was not interested in doing a show. But Leslie and I, kind of before the pandemic, were already talking about, wouldn't it be fun to do a podcast?
Mm-hmm.
And so it kind of happened. And then the planets aligned and Jimmy quit and Cubby came in.
And
it was perfect. We had these off the wall conversations about who would be number one on our wish list to have. And it was Cubby. Both of us were like, Cubby, he'll never do it. Cubby, he'll never do it.
When you first said Cubby, I was like, that is like the perfect person because he covers pop culture all the time. And we had this great long relationship with Cubby. I just didn't know if he would have time to do it.
Well, all kidding aside, we joke all the time about it. I don't have time for this podcast. I don't feel like I always joke about being a third wheel. I got to be honest with you guys. I'm doing this because of you two. And also, Barnes, I said, if I'm going to do a podcast, I'm going to do it right. And Barnes, you just make everything look so slick. And we're doing things that I never thought we'd be doing. And I it took me a while to get used to it. But video and, you know, the little promos you make. And my wife just says, you know what? This show is perfect for you because you have two friends and it just looks good. I mean, we stand out. I'm sorry, but there's a lot of podcasts out there. And I didn't want to do one if we didn't stand out. And Barnes, you do a great job at editing week and just doing all this stuff to make it look like a top-notch show. It's fun.
Basically what Cubby is saying, and it's true, Barnes does all the work.
Listen.
And making it look good
does.
And editing. And listen, you put hours into
this really do.
Show and we really appreciate it. Because we come in, we do the thing, and then we walk away for a week.
Now you're right. Right. You are right. You're right.
Now that you
paint it that way, you're right. And thank you. Thanks for noticing. No, we have fun. Literally, we're lifelong broadcast people, and it's in our blood. I mean, I look forward to taping this show every week. Just about.
I agree.
Almost every week.
It's really good, though, to have people, like-minded people, just kind of riff off each other about what's happened in the world and pop culture.
Well, we're going to share.
It's funny, we tape on a Sunday.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's funny, we tape on a Sunday morning, but the only bad part about every now and then you get that text from Barnes on a Sunday night at 9 o'clock going, my life is an editing hell.
It only happens every now and then.
Working all day.
And we've been working through Cubby's technology to try and fix some of those problems.
Yeah.
If you only knew what we did, we do a yell test at the beginning of every episode where I yell into the mic and I see if I can hear Cubby's headphones echoing back from New Jersey. No kidding.
Right. Well, because I'm going deaf. You know, my memory's going, and I'm going deaf as well. So my headphones are pumping right now, but I have to bring them down a bit. So let me know if they're too loud.
But it's really funny because I'm on this remote farm, and I have, like, great Wi-Fi.
Better than Cubby.
I know.
It's so funny.
I said that to Barnes the other day. I go, I think Leslie's the one person that has no tech issues. I'm like, and she's on a farm.
I know.
Someone has said that never. And Leslie, the only one with no tech issues. All right, so this episode, we're going to get into our favorite interview of 2020. And I had a bunch of ties. You just have to pick one at some point. I'll go first. It happens to be that this first one, this interview that I chose, happened to live in my house for 2 months this year, a little over 2 months. He's a great guy that I met years ago. He is the director of Shark Tank and The Bachelor and The Bachelorette. And I always knew if we could get him on, that we would get a lot of inside scoop. And we got scoop that from 2020, some of the biggest stories that I had no idea were even coming. It was one of our most popular episodes as far as the videos that went out of all the clips of things that he had to talk about because he goes over all of the shows. It's pretty incredible to hear some of the guy has access to
a lot of behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, he lives on a street Next Door Neighbors with Kardashian, The Weeknd, like all these people. And it's just like nothing to him. But to us, we're like, more, more, tell us more. But he was filming Family Feud here and lived in our guest dungeon. And so we had him. So I just had to get him up two flights of stairs and put a mic in his hand. And it was fun. Let's go back. This is Ken Fuchs from earlier in the summer on the Pop Culture Show. Our next guest is the director of, as I put it last week, every show on TV, I think.
Pretty much.
Shark Tank, The Bachelor, Bachelorette, Family Feud, To Tell the Truth. Help me, Ken.
Celebrity Family Feud.
Celebrity Family Feud.
Misery Index.
Misery. See, I'm not kidding. Ken Fuchs, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Ken, how did you get started? I mean, this is pretty incredible resume. How does one get started as a director, and now you have this incredible resume?
Well, that's a good question. I think if you ask 10 directors, you'll get 10 different answers. My path was a little circuitous. I started in production right out of college, and I worked my way up in the production ranks, which gave me a really solid footing in how things are done, and actually, I think, made me a better director. And then somewhere along the line of being a production manager, a line producer, I started ADing, assistant directing, and then that led to directing. So I sort of moved up one ladder, jumped sideways into the more of the directing track, and then got my break on a late night NBC talk show called Later with Greg Kinnear, which was a 1:30 a.m. talk show that Bob Costas used to host. And then Greg took over, and I was the AD on that for many years, and then started directing that.
Well, what was the first big show? When I say big, prime time, how did that jump happen? Because while that's a big, 1:30 in the morning a.m. on a network is a, of course, is a big break, but the shows you're doing now are iconic.
I don't know exactly. I think I came around, my career kind of coincided with the advent of, there was always variety television and non-scripted television. And so I had the late night gig, and that led to a daytime talk show with Roseanne.
Oh,
the ill-fated Roseanne talk show.
But that did very well though, didn't it?
Not particularly.
No? I thought it did well.
No, it ran for 2 years and it didn't do.
Oh, you're Roseanne.
I'm thinking of Rosie.
Yeah.
Rosie, yeah.
No, not Rosie. Roseanne.
I can see that.
Bar. Yeah.
That had to be problematic.
It was incredibly complicated every day.
Did she just yell at people?
Yeah. Yeah. She'd yell at you and she'd love you and she'd hug you and she'd... She was unbelievable. It was everything you would think it would be. And I look back on it fondly, and she was actually, we actually were very close. But it was very difficult and just chaotic. It was just a lot of chaos in her life and in her brain, but super talented. She would have the interview once a week, and she would say things and ask questions that nobody else would ask. So I think she was actually brilliant and creative and talented in a certain way, and then sort of, challenged in another way.
Well, Ken, now you got me wondering. I know you don't work with Ellen DeGeneres, but she's been been hearing people say she's difficult. Do you know anybody at that camp?
Hundreds of people have been through that camp.
Yeah. Is this a sensitive topic?
Not for me. I have no problem. I don't know the woman. I actually did the pilot for that talk show. I directed it wasn't an airing pilot, so they call it a presentation, but because I was working with Telepictures on Bachelor, they brought Ellen into the stage where we were shooting a Bachelor show and did a quickie sort of talk show, a couple segments to see if it worked.
Like a mock-up?
Yeah, mock-up. Mm-hmm, exactly.
Wow. And exactly. And you're saying what? That she was difficult then?
Well, I don't know if it was difficult, but I certainly didn't feel like that warm and fuzzy feeling at the end of it. So I can't personally, pass judgment on her, but I know over the 17 years of that talk show, the stories coming out of there have been you know, pretty consistent and not very flattering.
So these stories aren't new. These have been going on for years. We're just not hearing. I mean, this is the first we're hearing of them.
Yeah, of course.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Well, all eyes are going to be on her next week when that show comes back, because she's going to have, you think she's going to give like a speech or something when she comes out? I
guess so. I mean, she has to do some kind of damage control. I think I read something recently where she's offering something to the staff and crew in terms of, I can't remember what I said, but what I read, but definitely there's stuff going on there.
She'll have to pull an Oprah, you know, and go, you get a car to everybody in the audience.
Maybe. Something.
Maybe. And maybe she didn't know everything that was going on. I know those executive producers a little bit, and I know a lot of the stories revolve around the atmosphere on the show and not necessarily Ellen, you know, per se and exactly personally. So there's always, you never know on any show really what the disconnect is between production and the talent.
Ken, when the audition process is happening for a lot of these shows, I mean, obviously you're looking for larger than life personalities. What sort of things are you guys looking for? Because, you know, it's got to make for great TV.
You know, it's really, I think it's hard to pinpoint, and that's why it's hard to know what will work. I'm not involved on the executive level or the corporate level in terms of deciding who they back for a show and who they don't. But I've done a handful, and I've done some that I thought would be very successful with really talented, lovely people. I did the Megan Mullally daytime talk show and for NBC, and it was an incredible experience, but it didn't quite catch on. And, you know, for whatever reason, didn't go forward. And then I've done shows, you know, that I've done great shows that don't go move forward. And then I've done other shows that, like The Bachelor, that, you know, have lasted 20 years. And I don't know if there's any explaining it, really.
Well, any show you watch, if you pay attention, you're going to see at the end, directed by Ken Fuchs.
Let's hope.
Let's hope. It's funny to hear you go, yeah, I need to pick up another show. I'm like, dude, you have Shark Tank, it's Bachelor, unreal. Bachelorette.
But you know this business, Steve. If you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards.
Well, so you're pretty forward.
I'm pretty lucky. Let's put it that way. I have two shows for 20 years and one for 12. That's almost unheard of. And I thank my lucky stars every day. But, you know, all three could get canceled tomorrow. And then, so you always want to be meeting new people and challenging, you know, yourself to, you know, expand your career.
Ken, I love the behind the scenes stuff. So one of the things I heard early on, I think Barnes, you told me first, is it true they do like the rose ceremony taping? Usually like it, by that time it's like 5 a.m. because they've been drinking and hanging out. And that's why sometimes everybody's a hot mess. Is that true? Like the rose ceremony is always like early morning practically?
It's a long night. Bachelor is a long process, and it's a long night. And part of it is, right, so the first night, you know, they're meeting 25 to 30 people. So that's just an incredibly long process anyway.
And there's a bartender cubby, full on.
Anything you want, right?
It's a huge bar.
Not me.
No, yeah, but the bar is huge.
Well, the bar and that whole situation's also been toned down over the years because it got, you know, it was a little bit much, but each rose ceremony, as the season progresses, there's fewer, you know, cast members, the nights get, you know, shorter and shorter. So yeah, the first night's really very long.
How do the people keep track? So when you're talking about these 20, the first night, there's all these people,
right?
How are people keeping up with these side storylines and with all the things that are going on in that house?
The producers, you mean?
Like, so is there a producer for each person?
Not quite, but there's a lot of producers and there's story people, and you just kind of, you know, like any other reality show, you're behind the scenes, you're monitoring and keeping track of conversations and what's going in which direction and who she's talked to and who she hasn't and who needs time and who's going to get time, and somebody will get into a situation where they're sitting down for a one-on-one with her, and some guys might meet her and with, you know, three of them, well, three on one at once. Or we try to let, you know, I think over the course of the first night, we try to give each guy or each gal a chance to have at least a few moments with them.
Cubby, Leslie, as you go into that house, which is actually someone's house, the Bachelor Mansion, how long has the guy lived there? A couple of years?
No, or long? He's been there a while.
So you go in,
Well, we've been there like eight years.
Yeah, a long time. You go in the garage and they've transformed this guy's garage into literally a control room. So there are cameras. I mean, there are screens all over the wall. There are people watching every little move. Then you go into what room has to, there's a room with all these producers who are watching individual feeds and like what, crafting storylines?
Exactly. Yeah, no, there's chances for everybody to watch everything, and you can kind of call up what you want to see or what you want to hear.
It's amazing.
Yeah, no, it's like if you were in a television studio, you'd have a control room or a truck. So when you're on location, you have to build out that infrastructure and that technology, which is a massive undertaking, and our crew, our team is incredible.
Have you guys ever busted anyone having sex?
No.
I'm surprised with all the liquor that's flowing and just the people trying to make a statement, whether it's a guy or a girl.
No, there's not really that much opportunity for them to be alone off camera. And
I mean, like they know the cameras are there, but they're like, screw it, I'm going to go for it.
Right. No, now you're getting more into the Bachelor in Paradise world.
We can shift to that.
I don't do that show, so I can't speak on Bachelor in Paradise specifically, but I think the rules of Bachelor in Paradise are different than the rules on Bachelor. The rules on Bachelor have always been try to keep things, you know, we don't want to have that happen early on because it just takes.
Well, Fantasy Suite is a Fantasy Suite.
Fantasy Suite is what is episode 9, right, when they're down to 3.
Okay.
So until they're down to 3,
keep it in your pants. Until they're down to 3, and then it's all game on.
And then it's all good. Yeah.
Ken, one of the shows you work on that I am obsessed with and literally can binge all day is Shark Tank.
Oh, right on.
Do the sharks know in advance who they're about to meet?
So here's a very interesting thing about Shark Tank, and it's really fascinating, because when you think about producing, like if you were producing a show, you would want your talent to have as much research and information about what they're about to see and hear, so they'd be prepared to make good television or radio. In this case, and the producers were right on about this, it's exactly the opposite. They literally do not and cannot know anything about the companies or the products or the businesses, because it would give them an unfair advantage, but B, you would lose the whole process of discovery. And that discovery, so when you walk out on that rug and you say, I have a scissor that cuts, you know, through anything or whatever it is, then they go in, they start from ground zero. Who are you? Where are you from? What's your backstory? How did you get here? Why did you get here? What are you going to do with the money? What's your long range, you know, strategy? How do you scale? What, you know, all that, all those questions, if they had any of those answers, they wouldn't ask those questions. And that discovery process is what's so interesting to you and me as the viewer, is these really brilliant investors asking really thoughtful and deep and important and meaningful questions that I either wouldn't have thought to ask or I wouldn't have put together. And that discovery process is really the whole show.
And I could watch 15 of those in a row. Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's an hour. When they come in and pitch, right, Ken? It's an hour, ish?
The shortest ones, you know, so it's edited down into, there's 4 per hour, so there's 6 acts. So some, 2 of the businesses get 2 acts, and an act is like 7 or 8 minutes. So, right, it's basically a half, it can be as short as a half hour, it could take as long as an hour and a half. But once they hit the rug, they do their 90-second pitch or 2-minute pitch, and then it's on. You know, it's just Q&A, question and answer. And it sort of needs to go as long as the shark needs to go. We're a little bit at the mercy of the sharks because they're spending their own money. So we could hope that Mark, you know, Cuban makes a decision really quickly and decides to spend $500,000, but it's $500,000. And if it takes him an hour to get to that decision, then it takes him an hour. So
it's fascinating to watch.
It is fascinating. And I'll tell you what, what's really interesting to me is the whole process. Like when that hour is cut down to 8 minutes or 15 minutes, it's still great on TV. Obviously it's the best of the best, but sometimes just that long process of watching it all go down in the studio is really fascinating.
As an entrepreneur, like Leslie, I will sometimes when I'm in LA and they're in production, I will mark off a day on my calendar and I'll go there and I'll sit from like 10 a.m. to 6 at night and watch the entire thing. Ken comes
out. I totally
see like,
that. Yeah.
Ken goes, dude, are you bored? I'm like, no.
It's fascinating.
I mean, literally, it's like you're watching business deals go down with billionaires and you're a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
They all play their roles so well, especially, you know, Mr. Wonderful.
Yeah, they've all, right, that's right. Over the years, yeah, they've sort of crafted and created their own personas, and Barbara's, you know, Barbara, and Robert does his thing, and Lori, but Mr. Wonderful's, you know, one of my favorites too.
Ken, because, will they set up a clunker? Like, all right, we know this is not going to go well, but we got to put it on.
Not really, but you know, we shoot, it was a 22 episode, so we have 88 companies, and we'll shoot a few more than that. And in that, you know, we prepare them to do well. In other words, we don't want them to come out there and lay an egg and not be ready. So the producers work with them, you know, for a while to get them up to speed and to what to expect and to do their best. But this certainly turns out to be clunkers. And sometimes they're, you know, just, we can't have everyone get a deal, right? That's not the goal, and that's not as interesting. But also the sharks aren't, you know, they're so smart, they're going to get to something that probably or might be problematic, and then they're going to pass.
And I think some people listening might think that you're just covering for the show when you say that they don't know anything. What's fascinating is everything's covered up. So when they change out, like say between Cubby pitching and Leslie pitching, the Sharks go over and grab M&Ms and do whatever they do, go to the dressing room, whatever, and then they bring out the new stuff. It's all covered. And then the Sharks actually have a team sitting, you know, 50 feet away on their laptop who also don't know what's coming. So then Cubby comes out the door and these guys are like researching it like for the first time.
Wow. Yeah, you don't want to have them again. You want that process of discovery. You don't want
it's cool
knowing. And so we keep the props and the art department on one side of the stage away from the Sharks and away from their.
I love that it's authentic.
Yeah, it's pretty authentic. Exactly. And look, that's always the word everyone throws around. And that's really, it's really the word. It's really, really the critical part of what makes any of these shows successful, Bachelor included, which is the authenticity. If you really believe and you feel and you know that this is happening live and in the moment, it's just so much better.
Do you think you're desensitized to these personalities and these billionaires? I think that it would be weird to be around that many people as your job every day that are that influential, and you're seeing this like circus of, you know, A-plus personalities moving around, and you're directing them.
Yeah, I guess so. Although they're sort of in my backyard. Like the stage, that's my familiar place.
Yeah,
not
true.
More so than theirs. Now, if I were to go into their companies or their boardrooms, I'd probably be nervous as hell and freak out. But they're in my playing field, and they want to do well, and they want the show to do well, and they want to come off well, and they want them to do good deals. So we're there to sort of help them, and they're also just lovely, lovely people. Our six, we've had great guest sharks, but our six originals are to a man and woman, just lovely, sweet, nice, smart, collaborative people. So
it's intimidating. Cubby, imagine this. One of the times that I was there, we were going to go to lunch. Ken, we were going to walk like across the lot. It ends up being at one table, me, Ken, Richard Branson, and Mark Cuban.
That's a little intimidating.
And I just sat there and didn't say anything, hardly, until we started talking about the Caribbean.
Right.
But it was just weird to see these two billionaires just shooting it around. Hey, yeah, whatever. Hey, what Caribbean island should we go? I mean, it's just, and Branson, of course, owns a Caribbean island.
Right.
But it was just weird
that they were talking like we would be talking at lunch.
Like, yeah, and it's just like, yeah, it's normal. But then we go inside and Ken's like, hey, give me the phone. I need to get a picture. Like, you got a picture of Branson. That's the first time I've seen you do that. Like, get a selfie.
Yes, I was a little fanboy of Branson and A-Rod.
And A-Rod.
I had to get a picture with A-Rod and send it to all my Red Sox fan friends.
Hey, Ken, how's taping going to be going on with, you know, the COVID thing going on? Are you going to be in a bubble?
Yeah, we've done a lot of accommodations. All the shows have done a really great job. A lot, as you know, are back in production. Some are more remote, Zoom style, and you know, everybody sort of
remote, who's Zoom
remotely. Well, not well, like Wasn't The Voice the end of The Voice?
Oh, I thought you were saying your shows.
No. Different shows are doing different things. But basically, the non-scripted world is getting back into production pretty successfully and with super strict protocols, testing, masks, social distancing.
What about Shark Tank?
Plexiglass.
How is that going to work?
Shark Tank's back in production. And you'll have to see it. I don't want to give away too much.
Oh.
But we've tried all the shows. Same with Family Feud, which we're shooting here in Atlanta. We're trying to maintain the basic bones of the show, and so when you watch it as a viewer, and you'll be able to appreciate it, enjoy it just like any other season. But there are some ramifications and there are some accommodations in terms of like social distancing. And
but what about Sharks? Can you talk about where it's being shot? It debuts on the 16th.
I can't remember whether it's a secret or not, but what production has done is created a bubble, right? Exactly what you were saying, Cubby, is like we try to create somewhat of a bubble so that the cast and crew are safely in this together and without so much coming and going and external factors in terms of any elements that might create a COVID situation. So, but everyone's willing to do it. The crew is all very happy to do it. Everyone's thrilled to be back to work. And as difficult as it is with the masks, as I'm sure everyone knows, it's worth it to A, stay safe, and B, be able to be back at work safely and still making good television.
Do the Shark contestants come out with a mask on?
No, there's different. So the unions have done a really thorough job of like coming up with recommendations, and the IA and the DGA and SAG-AFTRA have really worked together on coming out with their blueprint for what production will look like going forward. And the on-camera talent has a mask. Everyone wears a mask as long as possible. But then if you're rolling and you're on camera, you can take off your mask. And then the hair, makeup, and wardrobe people, anyone working, they're sort of zones. So the zone closest to the talent, they call them different things on different shows, but those people are most heavily protected and protected for their sake and also for the artists, you know, for the talent's sake. And then people more behind the scenes like myself or in another zone, and we have different, protocols, but it's all the same stuff, wiping down everything thoroughly, constantly. So things are taking a little slower, taking a little longer, and that's okay because, we all want to be safe.
So, Ken, I have to ask this question. I mean, You're a mega director of all these television shows. What are you doing in Barnes's basement?
I ask myself that very same question all the time.
Because we have good steak.
The other day I went and I was like, I'm getting a little depressed, although it's really, I'm pretty happy to be here. And then I went and opened up my shade and I was staring at the ground and I realized I'm in a bunker, and it's a bunker mentality. And you know what? It's that mentality that gets us through production. Everybody's in it together. We're all just keeping our head down and working hard and not focusing on how things are different than they used to be. But no, I really appreciate Steve's offer because it's really beautiful.
It's like home. We feed him steaks. We take him to the local eateries.
It's not bad.
Laundry.
It's not bad.
Well, let's talk about your house in Calabasas, California. You have some very interesting neighbors. Like Kim and Kanye?
Yeah, Hidden Hills is kind of blown up. When I first moved to Calabasas, Hidden Hills was a little sleepy little town. And then, with the reality shows and who was it? Oh, Jessica Simpson. And
did they live in Hidden Hills?
No, they lived in my old neighborhood in Calabasas. And so that started the craze of like reality and shooting and Hollywood, and then people became very aware of who was out there. And I lived on the same street as the Jenners in my old house, and my boys grew up with Kendall and Kylie, and roughly the same age. They moved eventually. Chris moved to Hidden Hills, and the kids moved to Hidden Hills, and I moved to Hidden Hills And it's just the whole thing now out there.
Your house was it Nick Carter?
Yeah, my house was Nick Carter.
Nick Carter's house.
Yeah.
And they,
I have the gold record. When they took the gold records off the wall, like there's still like the mark on the wall from.
Dude, trick or treating in your hood must be insane. You got The Weeknd. You got Kim and Kanye. Who else?
I don't know.
No, you don't recognize them because they're wearing an outfit.
Yeah. I'm not sure they're doing the whole. I'm not sure. They do the whole trick or treat thing. Drake's in there.
Drake.
And there's a lot of old school Hollywood. It was like kind of a enclave of writers and composers, and it's a little far out of town, so it's not people who really want to have 9-to-5s necessarily, but a lot of creative types out there.
There's like a little van, Cubby. Leslie's sitting out in front of Kim and Kanye's. I guess that's their security. Like, is there some dude just sitting in there?
I'm sure there's security.
Yep.
Which is in a secured gated thing, and then you got the little dude in the van.
I haven't tempted fate, but
the little dude in the van. That could be a podcast right there.
Yeah. Hey, the next week on Little Dude in the Van. The reason he's here is because of Family Feud. And so what? It got moved back here. It was here for many years. It went to LA, and then why did it come back?
Right. When Steve Harvey took over, we came out here, and that was 10 years ago. We did 7 years here in Atlanta, and then Steve got very busy in LA with his talk show and Little Big Shots, so we just decided to do Feud back in LA because he was already in LA most of the time, and now he's back mostly in Atlanta, so we're back in Atlanta. So we were in LA for 3 years, and now we're back here. And Steve's just,
he's insanely funny.
I've met him a couple of times. Such a nice guy, too.
It's such a perfect blend of talent and format.
But the thing is, Family Feud sucks. Hold on, let me finish my sentence.
Wait a minute.
Sucks compared to when he's off on a break of Family Feud. If you could capture the commercial breaks, the dude is on all the time.
I can see that. Yeah.
He's unbelievable. And I'm like, Steve, why don't you take a break and sit down? You know, some hosts go in the back and take a break, or
he's like he's doing a stand-up gig.
He feels really committed to an audience that's come and to see him. And it's really like going to a live stand-up special every day.
Now he doesn't have a full audience.
Well, it's interesting. Now I thought it would really suffer, and I didn't know how he would handle it. You know, for some hosts and for some comics, that would be deadly not to have the 200 or 300 people out there. But he's amazing. I think his experience and his he's just such a hard worker. He's really giving it his all, and he's doing great. And the shows are as funny as before. And yeah, the audience is really just a handful of family members that aren't playing that game. And somehow he brings it to life, and he's doing
his thing,
his best job ever. Because when you watch it on TV, we'll sweeten it, and you won't ever know that it's not a full audience.
You know how he does that stare, Cubby and Leslie,
like he knows what we're all thinking.
Like he does a lot with his eyes.
Right, right.
Oh, his expressions are priceless.
It's great.
Yeah. Watching him tape one time, somebody gave him a wrong answer. And so a production person or something walked up and gave him a card, and the card said the wrong thing, right? So they start taping, and he goes, "Survey set." And like they do it, and it was the wrong thing.
Oops.
He immediately started making fun of himself when Miss Universe or Miss America or whatever, when they gave him the wrong card.
Right.
Remember that?
That was classic. Yeah.
Whichever one it was. He started making fun of himself. Like, you see him just like start rolling about, this has happened to me before. Like, and he just like, people are laughing and cackling. And then in an instant, he just snaps. I mean, it's like a snap, and he goes right back to it. And he goes right back to presenting the show.
Yeah. Yeah.
His outtakes.
Exactly. His outtakes are amazing.
They need to publish that.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. The long form.
So funny.
Streaming version. Too hot for TV.
Well, thank you for coming on. We could talk for hours about your shows. We need to mention, of course, that October 13th, The Bachelorette returns.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to put a gun to Ken's head to get some scoop, because there's all kind of talk going on about the drama happening on this season. I guess we're just going to have to watch.
It's so much better to find out for yourself.
Yes.
Ken, this was fascinating. Thank you.
Yep. Oh,
my pleasure. It's great to meet you guys.
Bachelorette October 13th, Shark Tank October 16th, and Bachelor when? Do we know?
Bachelor.
This year?
We're shooting, but it airs in its typical time frame, which is...
It's like January.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Roseanne's still canceled.
Roseanne's still canceled. I haven't heard from her. Yeah.
I don't know that you will. Yeah, she's off on an island. All right. Ken Fuchs, thank you for coming on the Pop Culture Show.
My pleasure.
Get exclusive video content when you follow the Pop Culture Show on Instagram. Unlock full video interviews and video bits you can't get anywhere else. Instagram.com/thepopcultureshow.
We are doing our best and most favorite interviews of 2020. Mine was Ken Fuchs, which you just heard from The Bachelor, Bachelorette, and all that stuff. Leslie, you're up.
So hard. I mean, I did have a couple of ties, and Barnes like, no, you have to choose one. So I'm going to say, without a doubt, Butch Walker, our friend Butch Walker, who,
oh, yeah,
if you don't know, is he was in several bands, one being Marvelous Three, but has become an unbelievable number one producer. He's produced everybody from Green Day and Weezer, multi-genre. He's an incredible artist, songwriter, entertainer. Like, if you've ever seen him live, it's just an experience. And he's just a cool dude. So I would have to say Butch Walker.
Analytics wise, I'll tell you, because you guys don't know this because you don't look at it every day. This was our second biggest episode of the year.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Second biggest, most listened to episode of the year. You know what number one was?
Oh, man. Mm. Oh, wait. Mm. Our Lady Peace? Is it Ray Mayda? No.
No, it's Back in the Summer.
Oh, Back in the Summer? Don't tell me. I'm going to get this. Leslie, if you get it, yell it.
I don't know if you're going to get it.
Air Supply.
Yep, I was about to say, I'm all out of love.
Right. Yep, that was our first one, I think, wasn't it?
Maybe.
That was interesting,
your
too.
First one. It was your first one.
Right. My yeah. first one,
maybe
you guys,
second.
Yeah.
Maybe second. Right. First guest. So let's go back. This was Butch Walker on the Pop Culture Show. All right, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the multi-talented. This guy does it all every possible way. The guy is just the king. He is Butch Walker. What's going on, Butch?
Well, hello there.
How are you?
Man, I'm doing good. I'm just sitting in my dark, dirty basement, which I'm not lying. I wish I had audio, video for you to see, but it's the most disgusting basement I've ever seen. But I had to have a place to set up my recording rig while I'm getting my studio built. So
that's hysterical. We were just playing Better Now. I just played the cover, which I love.
Oh, thanks.
And I love the video, just seeing you play all the instruments and sing at the same time. You're bragging is what you're doing, Butch.
Totally. Not even humble. Not a bit, dude.
You covered that so early, though. You covered that before. It wasn't even a hit yet, was it?
It was brand new, I think. But
yeah.
Every once in a while, there's a pop song that just really, like, I can't stop singing. And that was one of them. When I'd hear it, I'd be like, God, I hate that I love this song. Or I love that I hate it. I don't know what it is. I just loved it. But I think it's a great song. And it was really fun just to, like, sometimes I get little bit free bits of time in the studio, and I try to just occupy those with doing a random cover here and there. So really
fun. And you finished it off perfectly with the artwork on the single when you had the tattoos around your eyes and stuff. I thought that was just, it was the full package, paying homage to Post Malone.
Totally, man. Well, so good to hear all of the, see you guys and hear you. I can see you guys right now, but I know you can't see me. So
we've been talking a lot about you and obviously your career, which is just off the chart. And I have to say this about Butch Walker, the producer. I don't know of any other producer that has seamlessly worked every single genre. And also working from superstars to really, like, brand new, independent, cool artist. And who else can do that? I mean, from working from everyone from, you know, Green Day and the Wallflowers to, you know, I was just talking to Elizabeth Cook, who you just produced. And she's like, there's nobody else better.
Love Elizabeth. Oh, well.
Do you listen to just about everything? Like, when you're deciding, you know, who you're going to work with, I mean, I'm sure that the music has to mean something to you. But what goes into that decision-making for you when you want to work or produce someone?
I grew up listening to every kind of music. You know, when you're young and living in rural Georgia, whatever was on the radio, I listened to. And so and my sisters had an eclectic bag of records. So, you know, I was listening to everything from, at the time, this would be like, you know, what was fashionable at the time was funk and disco and metal and punk and pop. And And so nothing was off limits. And my mom, who listened to, you know, Al Green and CCR and stuff like that, and loved Elvis. And I mean, there was just so much of it that I'd never had a filter for what I thought I was supposed to listen to and not listen to, which I loved. And I tried to just always keep that with me in my back pocket when I'm working with people in the studio, or when I'm looking at something to produce. I just think there's good music in every genre. And so I'm attracted to whatever, you know, strikes me as good or appealing or interesting, you know. And a lot of times it's who it is. Like if I meet with the person, I really fall in love with their personality and think that they've got a lot to offer and they're talented. That's part of it. Cause you know, life is too short to be in the studio making records with assholes. So, you know, it's always good to just be making records with good, positive, fun people that work hard and want to make great art. And I just, you know, there's no rules to me. So
really nice to meet you.
You too.
I've heard great things about you from Leslie and Barnes. And here's my question. You know, you mentioned all these great artists you've worked with. Who have you not met that you are really digging? Like, you're digging their sound and you would love to work with?
That's a good question.
Like, we were just talking about Billie Eilish on our show here.
Oh, that would be one. I think really? She's fascinating. I think she's amazing. She's her own. She's an independent woman. She is badass. She does her own thing. Everything about her is exactly why she's huge right now. And
you'd have to pry Phineas out of the room before I think that would happen.
Yeah, I know, but that's what's so great about it. I know, it's a brother-sister thing, and that's what's great about it is, you know, they made all that in their bedroom despite anybody telling them how to do it or what to do, which I thought was amazing. And those are the records that come along and make me so excited when they break the mold. Like, you know, when Macklemore got big because nobody, he ended up not signing to anybody because he just made the record himself with Ryan Lewis, and it was the biggest thing ever. And it was, you know, basically bucking the system, you know. And I don't know. I mean, I always tried to, I love the DIY thing myself. I mean, I came from, as Leslie will, you know, attest to, you know, I made a record in my living room in my underwear, and and she started playing it. Next thing you know, I had a top five hit on the radio that was done in a bedroom with like two microphones. And I just, that started me on the path to where I am now. And I never forget that, by the way, that's what put me to where I am today. And you know, so when I see a kid like Billy and even Phineas, you know, super talented, just sitting in a bedroom making completely experimental, amazing pop music, that is so rad, man. That is the coolest. So yes, that would be one of many, but it's kind of like going into Costco and walking out with nothing. You asked me a question, Cubby, that I can't even remember right off the top of my head now that you've asked me, but I'll wake up in the middle of the night with 17 answers. So
no, it's all good.
But you're such a prolific songwriter. It seems like to me that you can't get up and walk to the refrigerator without coming up with a song. And then you record it, and then you have time to do everybody else's records. But you're the king of these kind of anthem hooks. And I mean, one of my favorites off the new album is your grand hit called Fuck It.
Nice.
So, like, to me, you got up one day and you're like, yeah, fuck it. Oh, you know what? Turn on the gear. Let's go.
Right.
It was funny.
I love it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you like it. That was one of the last songs I did for the record because it was like I had the whole song and didn't have the chorus. And I think the chorus, I was saying something weird, like, you know, love is a something, drug, whatever. It was like, it sounded way too like 80s Aerosmith. But I was like, and then I finally said, "Oh, it totally works in that phrasing to say fuck it," and it fit with what I was talking about in the album too, which we can obviously get into or not. But that was like, but you know, I love that. That was my homage to early Toto, I think, in that song. You know, I wanted,
and clearly no intentions to get that as a single.
No, sir.
Beep, beep. Right, beep.
It would be funny if every time you did it, it beeped. You know. But yeah, that's, you know, I love big hooks. Those are fun.
And speaking of, you know, honestly, American love story and the theme of this, you have been writing this record over the last few years, but now, you know, during pandemic and social injustice and everything else, I mean, you went there, which is which is great. And you talk about growing up in the South in a lot of interviews. I grew up in Alabama. Well, you know, we have this, you know, systematic racism everywhere. But this is an album unlike a lot of your records. What has been the most inspirational thing for you putting this out there?
Well, okay, that's a good question, because I did the record over 2 years ago and I just sat on it. And I think that a lot of that was because I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know if it would be a record that I could go do a conventional tour on, because I didn't think it would be fair to just go out there and pepper in one or two songs from the record into my set of 30 years of music and it'd be taken out of context, because a lot of the lyrics on the record are sung from the firsthand perspective of very questionable protagonists, you know. So there's some really dodgy shit being said lyrically, and that's because if you take it out of context, people would be like, what the hell did he just say? You know, I didn't want to like cause that. So I felt like it was something that was its own thing. So we kind of said, well, we dub it a rock opera, obviously, is something you listen to from beginning to end. It tells a story. That being said, it needs to be its own show. It needed to be its own concert or whatever, where it plays front to back. But then you've got that whole thing of like, well, do I go out on a normal tour and then play a whole entire record that's new that nobody's familiar with front to back? Nobody wants that. Or maybe they do, but I'm always trying to at least think of the fans in mind when I go tour, because I'm blessed to still have an incredible, you know, I like to think rabid fan base. When they come to the shows, you know, we're all one and we get into the show together. So I didn't want to disconnect from them for 45 minutes straight in one setting. So I sat on it and I didn't do anything with it for 2 years. And then, you know, pandemonium 2020 happened and we were locked down and no one was putting out records. No one was touring. And I think they weren't. And that was synonymous with each other because, you know, they need to tour to put a record out and vice versa. And then, you know, it just felt like over the course of 3 years, the subject matter had not dated itself. It was still, it was worse than ever. When it had somewhat been dormant and, you know, not being talked about or addressed as much in the media or on the streets, but more behind closed doors over the last, you know, however many years. And so it just kind of came to a head over the last few years.
You're taking these, they're all first person. If you haven't listened to the record, do it. Listen to the whole thing. And he's taking on these different characters as he sings about these issues. Were you fearing alienation politics-wise? And I don't want to get political at all.
That's fine.
When you put something out like that, do you fear that, you know, your fans are your fans?
Yes.
And what if some of them, you know, have drastic opinions on that type of thing? Wasn't that a risk?
Yeah, and they did, and they do. And you know, I realize I don't live in a bubble, you know, for what it's worth. You know, I grew up in the South. I grew up in this. A lot of these stories are true.
Sure.
And it's fictional characters based on real shit. And so, you know, and living all over the country and going back and forth to the South, to the West Coast all the time and you know, touring a lot. I've gotten to see, I want to say, you know, I've gotten to see a lot in the last, you know, 30 years of doing this. And I had a lot to say about it, but of course I knew there would be some blowback because sadly everything is politicized now. Everything.
Yeah, everything.
And you know, you're not going to just do this record and think that people aren't going to get offended by it. I mean, they got offended when, you know, in the 70s when Randy Newman put out Good Old Boys, mm-hmm. which he was, you know, singing about, you know, Leslie's home state and my mom's home state, by the way. And so, but he was singing from first person perspective as well. And it was very like, what the hell, man, you know? But I kind of just looked at it as, you know, if I don't say something about it, then what's the point of it? It's not art, you know? I mean, some of my favorite music was spawned during times of, you know, protest and strife and whatever. And then there's so much amazing, important music out there. Not that I'm trying to say mine is, but I'm just saying it inspired me to make the record. And so why would I not put it out there if just because of what a couple of trolls online are going to say? And that's fine. Because I've said it a million times that if somebody's got a problem with me calling out bigotry and racism, then they're not my people. And I want to show them the door anyway.
Amen.
And that's fine. And I don't give a shit if I lost another thing. Jason Isbell said a great thing is like, if I lose half my fans, at least I get to keep all of my soul. And It's a beautiful thing. Only someone that prolific with words can say that. And I use it quite often because it's true. And luckily, you know, I'd say the reaction, though, amazingly has been super positive. And for the most part, it's been very positive. And you know, if you want to base it on like Instagram followers, you know, it didn't go down, they went up. And so I'll take that as this must not have offended, you know, a lot of them, you know.
Maybe. Why did you get off of Twitter?
Well, that was just a breeding ground for just trouble and for trolling and for hatred. And that's the same reason I'm not on my Facebook account. That's like all my socials are pretty much handled by management. But like, you know, when I'm in charge of doing the wording and doing the posting and copying to other social platforms and stuff, you know, it's easy to get wrapped up and get emotional about all these heavy topics right now. And you're just going to end up. And what was sad is like seeing that, you know, how many people that have, you know, I've been following you for years and I can't believe you would like, you know, say this and say that. And it's like, how have you not known me that well after all this time? Have you not listened
to... No surprise, people.
Yeah, it's like all of a sudden everyone's completely shocked and appalled that an artist has a different opinion as them. And it's like, that's just the way it's going to be. But with Twitter, I just got sick of it. And I was like, I have like 650,000 followers and I'm done. I hit delete and I was out. And, you know, I just wanted to stop letting it consume me because that shit's a drug and it consumes everybody. I see it. I see it all the day long, you know. Everybody's buried in their phones posting selfies and pictures of themselves and talking about their and talking about other things a lot. And I have to do it to promote just like anybody else does on like, say, Instagram or whatever. But man, I got to say, at the end of the day, you wake up sometimes and you go, God, this is so stupid. You know,
like, it's funny that you say that because, you know, you were mentioning Jason Isbell and, you know, and I follow like Tom Morello and people like that. And when fans get on there and go, shut up and sing, I'm like, what are you talking
Jesus
about?
Christ.
That is ridiculous. So I totally get why you're off of it. I know that I have friends that are like totally off Facebook because of the negativity.
Yeah.
People are looser on Twitter. They just say crap and they just feel like,
you know, YouTube
hide.
Is bad too. You've ever heard the comments on YouTube?
Well, yeah. YouTube to me is like, they were the original, you know, offender for sure of trolls.
Because YouTube is a great outlet. Don't get me wrong, but don't read the comments. Like the first comment will be like, this song is great. And then 400 people after that will be like, no, it isn't because this.
Right.
This.
Oh, yeah,
people just love to hate.
Yeah.
I mean, not everybody, but this group of vile troll people, they just love to hate, and they're going to hate no matter what it is.
And you know, we grew up in a generation where for the first half of our life, the internet didn't exist, and people didn't have a voice. Now everybody has a voice, and everybody can say whatever the hell they want behind a keyboard with anonymity, and that means no repercussions. And and so, you know, coming up, making music, people were in any kind of art, acting, movies, whatever. People were more reckless with their like there was no governor on it, so to speak, because you weren't worried about what people were going to say, because really there was no outlet for people to give you their opinion. You just had you had music critics, and you had film critics. And that was only like 10 people, you know, and they didn't really speak for the common listener and the common, you know, movie watcher or whatever. So now everyone's a critic. And I think they love that. It's a drug to them that they can actually be heard. And that's the other thing, too, is like on Twitter, it was easy for me to engage. It was easy for me to bite back. And I, as you know, I'm kind of a redneck, so I bark very hard back. If somebody barks at me, I bark harder. And that's just not productive because that's what they love. They love that they actually, I'm like, these are people that have been ignored their whole life. And all of a sudden, they can say something that will trigger you. And then all of a sudden, you're engaging. And it's a rush for them. They get like butterflies in their stomach probably when they're reading it and go like, oh my God, I actually got to this person. That's amazing. I matter, you know? So I just said, fuck all y'all.
And wrote a song.
Yeah.
I saw that interview you did with our friend Matt Penfield about your all-time favorite albums. We have some of the similar favorite albums like Elvis Costello, My Aim Is True, and Springsteen, Born to Run, Tom Petty. I have been dying to ask you, though, because I know how much you love Queen. Oh, what did you think of Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie?
You know what? I was pleasantly surprised because I'm always fearful of seeing music biopics because you go, even just watching the ones that were made for TV, which mm-hmm. were always horrendous growing up, and you would, and as a producer and a person who knows my way around the studio and gear, it would drive me crazy to see them in the studio singing into the wrong end of the damn microphone or something in a scene. And I'd just be like, no, the continuity's terrible. This is all wrong. That would never happen, you know, but you got to realize that, you know, a lot of people just, you know, a music lover is just going to watch it and not look for that stuff. So sadly, that ruined me a little bit, but I loved it. I thought it was, and I took my son who loves Queen as well. And by the way, I had nothing to do with that. He discovered it on his own. He's 13.
That's awesome.
And he loves musicals. He loves theater. He's a total like theater actor. He's really good. And so he loves the songs that are obviously way more like cinematic. And so Queen, he loves. And so I took him to see it and I was so pleasantly surprised with, obviously Rami Malek was so incredible.
So
he was uncanny.
Okay.
And I mean, without that, what are you going to do? I couldn't even imagine it being Sacha Baron Cohen, who I love, but I could not have imagined him being Freddie Mercury. Even though he does everything to me great. But Rami Malek was just incredible. I couldn't believe it. And it was so fun to see that it was all worth it just for the last 20 minutes of the Live Aid show.
Absolutely.
I mean, Jesus, they nailed every aspect of it when you watch it side by side. It's so incredible.
Butch, I want to ask you a question that not a lot of people can answer. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I think about. Just it comes through my brain, and when this happened, I thought about it because knowing you, what is it like to lose almost everything that you have? And I'm talking about the California fires. I can't imagine. I just got chills just saying that.
Yes.
Like I can't imagine what that must be like. And it's been years, I know, but still, what is that like?
Well, you know, you never think it's going to happen to you. And obviously it's not death, but it is some sort of a death. It's not as heavy weighted as a physical, you know, person passing,
right.
But it is a dying of memories and things that you'll never get back that were close to you and close and were, you know, family heirlooms and, you know, vintage guitar collection my first guitar as a kid that my uncle gave me to learn on and all these little things and not to mention like my girl's war, like her dad's, you know, war medals and,
wow.
And burial flag and things like that. I mean, heavy, heavy stuff. But after a couple of weeks of grieving and grieving pretty hard and then having to do all the math and of all the like accounting of everything gone and that you really, you know, you come out from it going, you know what, it's all just stuff and you can literally move on. You can move on. And there was a beauty in the load being so lightened that it was like, okay, well, where do we want to go? We can move and live anywhere. We can go anywhere. We could go live on a farm in Italy if we wanted to. We only have two suitcases to our name, you know?
Were you not home when the whole thing started?
No.
So you couldn't salvage anything?
No, the only thing that, it was New York. I was playing two shows. I was playing two acoustic shows and had my family with me. And my son was only 6 months old at the time. And so, you know, I came back with literally those two acoustic guitars and two suitcases. And that was all we had.
How did you find out it was happening?
My friend Ryan, who is from Atlanta, who lives in California now, and who actually helps me with my charity now, he's an incredible human. But he used to come to my old band Marvelous 3 shows when he would stand outside and wait for me to come out, and after the shows and talk my head off. And he was just this really hyper funny kid. And I remember he hit me up one time on a side note here. He hit me up one time online and said, "Hey, I'm thinking about moving to LA to try my hand at being a comedian or an actor. And I said, well, you'll be regretting it if you don't. So you should just go. It doesn't matter if it doesn't work out. You should try. You're young. Ends up later, you know, I run into him at the grocery store out in Malibu one day. And I was like, what are you doing? He said, well, I came out here. He said, but it turns out I got a scholarship to Pepperdine University.
Wow.
And so he rode motorcycles. So we started becoming motorcycle buddies and riding all over the place. And he's the one who that morning I had neighbors that were saying, they were hitting me up at 5 a.m. West Coast time. And I was in New York. And I was walking my son in Union Square, and I started getting phone calls and stuff saying, dude, are you home? You got to get out. You got to get out, because the hillside was on fire where my house was. And I said, no, I'm in New York. I mean, I don't know what's going on, but obviously there's a lot of close calls out there and a lot of scares. And so I didn't kind of take it with a grain of salt after being out there for only a year that there had been a couple of close calls with the weather. And so I hit Ryan up and I said, hey man, just in case, will you just go to the house and grab like some personals and stuff just in case, and like maybe some guitars and some war medals and things like that. So, and so he dropped everything and went there. And then he called me. I remember he called me and he was like coughing and choking and out of breath. And I was sitting in Union Square at a coffee shop with my kid in a stroller. And he was like, man, I tried to get in there. There was a barricade on your street. The cops had blocked it off. I ran over the barricade in my truck. Jeez. And went to the house, and I was trying to get up there, but the smoke was too crazy and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, man, I'm just so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I was like, what are you sorry about? And he goes, man, your house is just gone. Oh. Everything's gone.
Oh gosh.
And, yeah. And I just kind of, I broke down right there at this coffee shop. And I was just like, God, how am I going to go back to the hotel and tell everybody about this? And that was the longest,
heavy
longest walk of my life back to the wow. hotel room. And it was crazy. You know, it was just a big shock. But, anyway, that was the beginning of a beautiful relationship with my buddy Ryan, and who is to this day now has his White Heart organization that helps amputees, veterans, wounded veterans, and raises a bunch of money. And now he's working for my pancreatic cancer charity, which is in the honor of my late father, Big Butch. So it's good. We have a good relationship now.
Thank you for.
Man, I'm sorry that happened to you.
Thank you for kind of recanting that story, because I know it's painful. But
it's weird. It's been so long. I got to the point where, you know, I would just make jokes about it now, about like, oh yeah, I had that guitar, it burned, you know, and I would just kind of make jokes about it. But when I tell the story, I still get choked up, you know.
No, man, we're getting choked up hearing you tell the
heavy,
story.
Yeah. It's a heavy load, you know. It's a heavy thing. But
thanks for sharing.
But it's okay. Yeah. But you know what? Just, like you say, it is just stuff, and it is
right.
And I realized how important, more than anything, of having people in your life and having friends, was so much more important than having two of everything and having, you know, watches or guitars or motorcycles or anything like that. None of that stuff mattered if you have no friends and you have no people that love you and have no people that would come to your beck and call. And man, I was overwhelmed with people just coming and saying, dude, you need to borrow. I mean, I had Brendan O'Brien and Michael Beinhorn and Jack Joseph Puig and these huge producers all coming to me and going like, dude, I couldn't imagine if that happened to me. If you need any of my gear, if you need to borrow anything, it's yours. You can have it as long as you want. Had people showing up with clothes and stuff. And I was like, man, I'm okay financially at that point. You know, I was like, I actually don't need this stuff, but I can't believe people would reach out to do that. And so, you know, although I did take some of the clothes because I was wearing the same pants that I came home. I only took one pair of jeans with me to New York, and I wore those until I couldn't wear them anymore. So it was nice to have. It shows you how important family and friends are.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, Butch, like, so on a much lighter note, let's talk about like right now as we speak. I know you're in a dark basement. You're probably in your studio with your studio gear all around you. Are you currently producing something right now, or what are you doing?
Yeah,
right now?
It's been you know, surprisingly very active this year. I've done a lot of records this year, and even during lockdown, I've been finishing up on a few records that were needing to get done that I worked on before everybody had to, you know, stay out of the studio. So I mean, you know, I was lucky enough to. We were lucky enough to get the new Green Day record out and before all the lockdown happened, and it went to number one, and I couldn't have been happier about that, because that was a labor of love working on that record with those guys. And And then after that, I had a couple of other records here in the pipeline that I've done, which I guess I could go ahead and let the cat out of the bag on the ones I'm working on, because they're not going to be out for a minute now that there's, you know, now that we're in a pandemic, but they are coming out.
Scoop.
I was working on, so I just finished a record for Jewel, which is an amazing record. Nothing like she's ever done before.
Love Jewel.
Uh-huh. She's
former top fiver.
She is. She's incredible. Still should be.
Yeah, she's gorgeous.
Yours. But and then just did a new record for the Wallflowers.
Oh, that's awesome.
Which is incredible as well. I'm super proud of that one. Finishing up a Matt Nathanson record, which is very good. Love that guy and love this record. And
hold on, back up to Wallflowers.
Yeah.
They're such a unique sound that they have. What are you doing to them? Don't mess with that.
Nope.
Don't mess with that.
Nope, dude, you think Jacob would let me?
True.
He's one of the rare instances, and he and I have been friends for years, and you know what's funny? That dates back to our first time meeting each other, Leslie, was at the Christmas show that I came in last minute with Marvelous 3 to take the place of Vertical Horizon for the Christmas show when they canceled last minute.
And
it was us and the Wallflowers on the bill. Mm-hmm. And we played, and the Wallflowers, of course, they were scheduled to headline. So I remember Jacob, that was the first time that I met him, because when we got off stage, he came up to me and he goes, "You mean we have to go on now after that?"
That's how everybody feels.
And because we were whatever, we were so crazy and hyper and like put on a high energy show, and you know,
and he's so chill.
He's so chill, but you know what? He lets the songs do the talking, and I learned a lesson from that too. Of like, I need to try to aspire to write songs as good as this guy can write. And I'm telling you, he still writes them just as good. So
he's so good. I love them.
And we've all become close. All of our families have become super close. Vacation together a lot of, throughout the years. That he finally asked me, and I never pushed it because I was like, one day that dude needs to ask me to make a damn record for him, and I'm never gonna. I don't like push it on people, you know.
You're like, hey, I produce, by the way.
Yeah, no, and he knows, but he's he always has said, he's like, you know, we could never work together professionally because you just would not want to be my friend anymore. And so he finally said, I want you to make a new Wallflowers record. I said, let's go.
Of course. Yeah, I love the Weezer record you did too.
Oh man, we had a fun time doing that too.
It's funny, I think I remember texting this to you several years ago, but we did a crossroads at CMT with Fall Out Boy and talking to those guys about you, and they were like, yeah, we were kind of punks and Butch set us straight. But they basically said, when you do a record with Butch Walker, you're suddenly cooler.
That's funny to me, but I mean, you know, that's I love hearing that, obviously, but it's certainly, I don't know if that's true. I think we just had such an interesting chemistry, you know, between me and Pat and Pete, and they had such an interesting, like, Elton John, Bernie Taupin thing going, where all the lyrics are written by the bass player who doesn't sing a lick.
Right, right.
And all the songs are written and composed by the singer who doesn't write lyrics. And it's just, but man, what a combination. So super fun to work with, and I love those guys so much.
Can you please just mix our podcast so we can put on there "Mixed by Butch Walker"?
Sure.
I'm gonna send you the files.
Sure.
And then all of a sudden, Rolling Stone's gonna say, "From Taylor Swift to the Pop Culture Show, Butch Walker."
You know, Butch. I was telling Barnes about last year at the Pilgrimage Festival, which one of my favorite festivals. Was the last time I got to see you live. But your live show is in the top five for me of all live shows. And, you know, we all go see a lot of...
So much energy.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, you're up there for me with, like, Soundgarden and Rage Against the Machine. But the energy level... But a lot of people go to concerts and it's like a social event. But when they go see Butch Walker, your fans are with you from beginning to end. And, you know, you look out into the crowd and it's people of all ages. What is happening in your mind when you are on stage? Because you go somewhere else.
I do. And thank you for the kind words. I mean, I just love playing and performing and getting out all of my aggressions and sadness and madness and everything that happens throughout the day, all the bullshit. You get 30 minutes to 2.5 hours, depending on what I'm doing, headlining or opening, to just get it all out. And it's therapy. And even if I'm playing to an audience that I don't know, you know, I love the challenge of like trying to just get them engaged. And I love when I play to, you know, to my group of people that come see me play my own shows. There's just a, man, why would I not want to connect with them? Why would we not want to make this fun for each other? And I grew up on those kind of artists. You know, I grew up on those performers, like, I mean, Springsteen and Petty and Freddie Mercury and all these artists that just made the, that were the best showmen and just were able to just capture everyone from the first note to the last and never let go. And that's just, that's performing, and that's a show to me, you know, not just going through the motions of playing the songs, you know?
Yeah, definitely like a Springsteen concert.
Yeah, your talent is, I mean, we're not just blowing smoke. I mean, so many years and so many gigs we've been to, it's unbelievable how much energy you have and how much of a connection. I mean, there were several women this week that I bumped into who've been in Atlanta for years, and they said, who's on your show this week? I said, Butch Walker. They stopped in their tracks. They were like, you've got Butch on?
Well, that's because Butch marries people at his shows.
I have.
That's true.
I actually, you jumped off stage one time and married a couple in a crowd. I heard
I'm
about
indoctrinated.
That.
Yes, I've actually gotten in several
Love
states.
That.
And whenever somebody hits me up and they say, hey, can you, would you, you know, we've been, and it's always about their story, you know, it's like if they've been like, oh, we've been fans of yours since we were 15 and we met at your show and now we're getting married And would you officiate it? And I'm like, oh hell yeah! Are you kidding me?
Internet Jesus!
Yeah, totally.
Love it.
Totally. And I actually said I would do an entire tour that way. You know,
that would be hysterical. Butch, thank you so much for taking the time to come on with us. It was fun. We're gonna have to do a second part of this someday because there's so much.
We could talk to you for hours.
We could talk about.
I could talk to you guys for hours. You guys rule. Thank you so much, and what a great chance to catch up with all of you.
We're definitely
so
gonna
awesome
do it again
and see you.
Thank you, Butch.
Thank you.
Thank you. Make me a promise.
Stop it before we begin. Hey, today's Best of 2020 is brought to you by Luna Nuda Prosecco. Luna Nuda Prosecco is perfect for holiday celebrations, whether it's ringing in the new year or toasting to your family and friends around the dinner table or virtually. We love our Luna Nuda Prosecco, baby. Mm-hmm.
My eyes have been open to Prosecco. I never even considered it before until I tried this.
Delish.
Yeah.
$13.99 at Publix. You kidding
right.
me?
And normally you wouldn't buy something that says $13.99. You would think it tastes like garbage.
Yeah.
But it
what
tastes
a great
so
gift too.
$109.99 is what it tastes like.
We've already taken it to a couple of people's. We've had a couple of dinners.
Yep.
Socially distant dinners.
Socially distant. I've taken some too.
And that's just it's the perfect thing to bring.
I totally agree. Yeah. And you can toast to the new year.
Yeah, whip it into the Publix or whatever your store is in your neighborhood and pick it up. Luna Nuda Prosecco. Cheers with Luna Nuda.
Wanna get intimate? Subscribe to The Pop Cult at thepopcultureshow.com and get VIP insider access to the show with bonus content, exclusive videos and freebies. Anything happening on the show will come to you first. Sign up free and join The Pop Cult at thepopcultureshow.com.
We shall continue with the 2020 best, 2020, like Barbara Walters, best of 2020. These are our favorite interviews. I had Ken Fuchs, director of The Bachelor and all those shows, Shark Tank. Butch Walker was Leslie's. Cubby, you're on the spot. Who's it going to be?
Well, I'm not just saying this because you just mentioned that it was our biggest one as far as analytics go, but I'm going to go with Air Supply.
Really?
And simply for the surprise factor, I remember you said we were going to interview Russell Hitchcock from Air Supply. And I thought to myself, I didn't tell you this, but I'm like, Air Supply, really? I mean, what is this, a yacht rock podcast? I mean, I know they were a big band. I know they were a huge band, but really?
Huge.
But when we talked to him, and I remember how cool it was because you went to him and you had to set up with all your equipment around him. And it was early on in the pandemic. Anyway, I found his whole interview fascinating because I just love talking nostalgia. And he brought up some great stories from the Air Supply days. And it was just a surprise for me. I kind of went into it going, really, Air Supply? And then I remember leaving the interview a bigger fan. And I like loaded up my playlist on Spotify and my iHeartRadio playlist with Air Supply songs. I really enjoyed it.
But his voice is insane.
It really is.
I got to tell you, a documentary with Air Supply would be great. If the Bee Gees does well,
there
this
you
would
go.
Be huge.
And they've sold a shit ton of records in their
history.
Let's make
that happen.
And they're still gigging. I mean, they're still playing these sold out arenas all over the world. It's pretty nuts. We've gone to a couple of his shows and it's wild to watch these women just lose their mind. I mean,
that would be fun to do once shows get back in. I'd love to go to a show.
It's just hit after hit after hit.
I imagine, yeah.
Let's go back to it. This was Russell Hitchcock, Air Supply, where Cubby, let's listen for the moment when where Cubby like lets his surprise be known. Is there a moment where you're like, oh, wow, this guy's actually funny?
I remember, no, it wasn't a funny part, but I remember being nervous asking a very like generic question. You know, I try to avoid, how did you get the name Air Supply?
He doesn't
because
care.
It's such an easy question, but he actually gave a great answer. And I remember being like, all right, that went well. Because, you know, like as radio people, guys, we try to avoid the easy questions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How did you get the name? You know,
exactly.
I thought, okay, is this a dumb question? But he really gave an answer I didn't know anything about.
Let's go back to June 2020. Russell Hitchcock from Air Supply on the Pop Culture Show. You guys ready to bring in? We have a co-host this week, not just an interview, but like a full on co-host that's going to be employed for this episode only.
So me and Fram should leave? We're done? We're off?
You should leave.
Oh, I know this song.
You heard it before?
Yeah, a few times. Believing
for so long. How about this one? You know
you can't fool me. Hit after hit.
I mean, I can go as long as you want me to. I used to think I was tied to a heartache. That was the heartbreak, but now that I found it.
Couples
should I keep
only.
Going?
Oh, keep going.
Cubby's pantomiming that one. That's good.
No, I'm thinking about the roller skate DJ saying couples only right now. Couples only.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our co-host from the multi-platinum band Air Supply. Russell Hitchcock is here.
Unreal.
Good Thank morning. You.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
A roller blast from the past, those songs that you just played.
Yeah, I asked him the other day. I said, man, you've been off so much during coronavirus, you should probably get a prompter. Because when you go back, I would be so confused with the word love in so many songs, I would be singing the wrong verse in the wrong song.
Well, that's the good part about having love in every song, because it's a frequent lyric. Hard to forget.
How did you get a legend on this podcast, Barnes?
It's a crazy story.
Steve for a while. I'm sorry, I thought you were talking about to me.
Yes. We met several years ago on a plane. Russell was there with his soon-to-be wife, Dina, and their dog, Chili. And we were sitting in the same area, and then we ended up sitting in the same area of the plane. And I think Heather started talking to Dina. Yeah.
Your wife.
Yeah.
Right.
Started talking to Dina. And then we get to LA. It's like, okay, see you later. And the place we were staying was four doors down from where Air Supply was playing that night.
It was meant to be.
That was the craziest part of it. I mean, literally, we drove past the marquee. It was very weird.
And then Russell wrote a song about it. We're so close. It was meant to be together.
And so since then, we have, here's a little side secret. We've spent every Christmas together for the last X amount of years. We have like a routine Christmas hang.
Wow.
And then during the year.
Major FOMO here. Yeah, I didn't
know
that.
I knew you were friends, but I didn't know like it was almost like family here.
Every Christmas and every night when The Bachelor's on. Those are the two times we get together.
That's
beautiful. We watch Bachelor episodes. We do a home and away. So they'll come over and watch with me and Heather, and we'll come over and watch with Russell and Dina.
And our dog.
And Chili.
Freaks out Steve's cats.
Yes. It's a very comical. We should be filming that for a little sidebar reality show, probably.
Well, Russell, where do you call home now? Are you living in Atlanta where Barnes is? And
yep, I live in Atlanta.
Okay.
We only live about 15 minutes from each other, so it's very, very cool.
We're in his basement right now. That's the mystery location.
Yeah.
Oh.
And Russell,
I wish I could show you all the cool guitars and platinum records and stuff.
Well, maybe you can walk around later and show us.
Well, luckily, we're audio.
Oh,
remember?
That's right. I forgot.
Yeah.
So, Russell, I mean, you guys have been touring nonstop since you started in the 70s. How
Correct.
Crazy has it been for you now with COVID not being able to be on the road?
This is the biggest break we've had since 1975. I think we would take like a week or 2 weeks off here once every couple of years. But now it's going on. Well, we played our last two shows in March. It's quite interesting to me, too, with the COVID thing. Just before we played our last two shows, we got a lot of flack from certain fans saying, how dare you put people's lives at risk? And
oh, that's, you know, coming up everywhere.
Yeah. And we were obligated to play. So we played, and everybody loved the fact that we were there. So consequently, the whole thing gets locked down, showbiz, everything gets locked down. So then we get mail saying, it's really unfair that you played for those guys, but you won't play for us. So you can't win for losing, is the right saying, right?
I've been seeing country artists lately doing outdoor shows,
yeah.
And people just you know, pulling up. Have you ever thought about doing some outdoor venues?
Well, you know, the last two shows we played were outdoor venues, but I mean, even from a punter's point of view, I wouldn't want to be sitting next to people, somebody I didn't know right now. And I saw a couple of country acts doing their thing. People jammed in front of the stage, no masks. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
I just saw Walmart's going to start doing concerts or drive-in. They're going to turn their mega lots.
Yeah, park in the parking lots. Walmart's all over the country. They're just trying to find a way to get people back to normal. But you're right, Russell. I mean, you put people at risk.
Yep. And as the numbers keep going, people keep getting more stupid.
This weekend, the footage on television is out of control from every state, everywhere. People are just like, F it. I'm done.
Right.
Yeah, it's July 4th. I'm done. I'm in.
Yep. And a bit of trivia too. The drummer for Foo Fighters, Taylor Hawkins, he called me up about 6 months ago and asked me if I would sing on his solo album.
Really?
But we couldn't get it together. But
that guy's awesome.
That's a compliment, though.
Big time. He's played drums for everybody. Matthew Sweet, Alanis Morissette, Foo Fighters. I mean,
amazing drummer.
Amazing drummer. I remember seeing him in Atlanta at a small 100, what a Smith's Old Bar hold, like 150, playing with, I think, Matthew Sweet at the time. It was very cool. Who have you had on stage, Russell?
Yeah, I was going to ask that.
Nobody really of note.
No one that's just happened to be there or?
The only one that was a minor celebrity was Glenn Campbell.
Minor.
Wow. He played guitar on Even the Nights Are Better in concert with us once.
Glenn Campbell?
Yes, he did.
Russell, were there any, did you ever meet any like musicians along the way that you were surprised they were huge Air Supply fans, like any big rock gods or anything?
Well, I guess the biggest one is Rudy Sarzo.
From Quiet Riot?
Played bass.
An Aussie?
Everybody, yeah.
In fact, yeah, you're
the first time I met him in the 80s, we were at this real famous club in Los Angeles called The Rainbow. And we were talking and he said he was a big fan, and it's always hard for me to believe that people of his ilk would like Air Supply. In any case, his parting comment was, whatever you do, don't tell anybody that I like your band, because my bandmates will give me shit for the rest of my life if I cop to being an Air Supply fan.
Hey, Russell, can I ask you a very, it's a very cheesy DJ question, and it's one I try to avoid when I do radio interviews, because it's like a softball question here. But I really want to know, the name Air Supply, how did you guys get that?
We'd recorded a few demo songs when I was in Jesus Christ Superstar with Graham in 76. And we didn't have a name for the band and we couldn't think of anything. And quite simply, and it's a cheesy answer, Graham came in to the show the next day and he said, I had a dream last night. I saw this billboard with lights around it and it said Air Supply in the middle. That was it.
I didn't know that story. Covey, actually, thank you for asking that.
You guys just celebrated, what, your 50th anniversary together, right?
45 years.
45 years. 45 years together. Not a fight. Not one time.
Not a fight. We don't have reason to fight. I mean, I love his songs. He's a great guy. And he's 6'5", so you don't want to fight with him anyway.
What was it like when you guys first broke? What year was that? When your music broke and like the fame started happening?
1980.
So was it weird being two guys singing duets? Did y'all get any flack from people?
Of course. You know, in fact, part of our shtick in the show used to be that I would say to people, we sing with each other, not to each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But we've been accused of being gay and bi and
that's
blah,
just
blah,
the internet. People are stupid.
Well, this was before the internet.
But you know what I mean? There was still that thought process, though, before the internet. Yeah, pre-internet thought process.
You can't be two guys singing songs together and not be involved in a relationship. You know?
What do you think of the whole term yacht rock being thrown in that?
I don't even know what...
He just asked me what it was.
I didn't even know what it was till 20 minutes ago.
No, we're going to school him.
It's amazing that your voice seems to get better over time. And I mean, the records, your voice sounds better than the record now. And that could be that the technology wasn't as good then also. I mean, the mixing and mastering has all changed.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't agree with that. When I listened to the few snippets that you played, my voice has dropped quite a bit. And it's much more difficult to do it now. In the old days, especially in the 80s when we started, we'd be on the road for 10 months a year on a bus, not go home. We'd play four shows a week, go out and party really hard every night.
I don't believe that for a minute.
And get up and do it again the next evening. Now it's like I do a show, have a glass of wine afterwards, take me 3 days to recuperate.
But you're still playing how many gigs a week? Not talking coronavirus. Obviously, you're paused. But
well, we do about 130 shows a year. So if you do the math, it's a lot of shows.
That's a lot of shows. That's every 3 days at least doing a show.
Yep, absolutely.
So, Russell, I noticed, I know Wikipedia isn't always right, but it says past members, and there's like 30 of them. I mean, there's a lot of past members of Air Supply.
Oh, I couldn't even name all of them. In the very beginning, there were three of us. Unfortunately, we had to part company with one of the guys. And then we figured, we kind of knew that Graham and I would be together for as long as Air Supply was alive. So we figured we'd just do all the publicity, all the stuff ourselves. In fact, we just put out a new tour book a couple of years ago, and the drummer that was in the book left. So it's very difficult. But, you know, people want more money. They get big heads. They get whatever they do. Some guys just can't hack the road anymore. Some stop playing with us on the road because they have families that they need to take care of at home.
But that's got to be tough. They're coming into such an established band that you can't expect that you're going to have equal, you know, that you're going to be like involved in every aspect of a band that's been around 30, 40.
No. I mean, it's made very clear to them now that, you know, we want them to play with us, and they're more than happy, all of them, because we get to go to play. I mean, we play all over the world, places that I'd never dreamed of playing before. We've been to Vietnam and Dubai and Beirut, and anyway, and as long as they're happy and as long as they want to do their job, we're cool with it. But it's like anything. I mean, if you, the business you guys are in, sometimes you love it, sometimes you hate it, sometimes you want to leave, and sometimes you do. Mm-hmm. You know,
Russell, being such an international star and being the lead singer of Air Supply, along the way you probably have met some pretty cool people, I'm sure. One person that has stood out to you all along the way that you've met, that you look back on and went, wow, that was pretty cool?
Yeah, we played a show in India in 95, I think, and we were getting a VH1 award over there for something. And the acts on the same bill were Robert Plant, Brian May, and Roger Taylor from Queen, Brian Adams, and a bunch of others. And the concert was held in a football stadium, so the backstage was just a bunch of pipe and drape, you know, curtains. There were no dressing rooms per se. And I was walking to go to where we were stationed, and I saw Robert Plant. And I freaked out because, you know, he's Robert Plant. And he had a bunch of reporters around him, and they were all had their microphones stuck in his face. And as I got to within, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet, I heard him say, "Excuse me," and he broke it up and he put his hand out and he said, "I'm Robert Plant. It's a pleasure to meet you."
Wow.
And that's the biggest thrill of my life for sure.
What about, didn't you meet Princess Diana at one point?
Yeah.
What was that?
We played for the Australian Bicentennial in 1988 in Sydney. Every act that ever had any success in Australia was there. And, of course, there was the greeting line at the end of the performances. So we got to meet Prince Charles and her. She was beautiful inside out, gorgeous in every manner. Her personality, her compassion, her interest in, you know, you thought you were the only person in the world when she was speaking to you. That was another big thrill. Thanks for the reminder.
What did she say to you? Because I'm sure she was aware of Air Supply.
I can't be like verbatim, but I know that she said that she loved the music. But her biggest, I had this sterling silver bow tie, and she was quite fascinated with that for 5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. I love your bow tie. Where did you get it? What's it made from?
Did you get a big hug from her?
No, are you kidding me?
How about a picture? Do you have a picture?
Well, actually, if you YouTube Air Supply Princess Diana, you'll get to see us have a chat for a couple of minutes.
I bet she was beautiful in person.
Yes, stunning.
Stunning.
You know, some of my favorite groups have come out of Australia in addition to you guys. I mean, off the top of my head, I don't even have this written down. Ice House is amazing. Men at Work, NXS, AC/DC. Have you hung out with any of these groups?
In the early days, in 76 and 77, we were on the road in Australia quite a bit. And in those days, it didn't matter what you played, what kind of music. Everybody was happy to have a job. Everybody was happy to be able to do what they loved. And I went to do my laundry in one of the hotels we were staying at once, 3 a.m, and Bon Scott was there.
No.
Yeah. So we had a chat for a couple of hours, and once again, you know, totally unexpected, appreciated each other's success and talents. Just another great guy.
If you're listening and don't know who that is, that was the lead singer of AC/DC, the original.
Yeah. Right. And, of course, we were good friends with Little River Band.
Oh, right.
When they were in Australia, and they were, all the original guys were there. They're great guys. Ice House, I knew Ivan pretty good, the singer-songwriter.
It's the Australian Brotherhood.
There you go. We used to call it the Australian Mafia.
And Russell, you're a big fan of The Bachelor / Bachelorette as well?
Yeah.
Huge.
Huge. Yeah.
We used to,
I can't tell if you're serious or not.
No. Okay. This is not all right. A lie.
No. All right. Because I know Barnes is.
Oh, yeah. All in.
Yeah. We were lucky enough to do the finale of The Bachelor. When was that, last year?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
You played in front of them, right? That's right. I forgot about that.
But the coolest thing was, after the taping was done, we went back to the hotel, and all these ex-Bachelor Bachelorettes came in for a drink. And my wife was in heaven because she was sandwiched between Ben and...
They were freaking.
Other hunk. You know?
But you and I were silently freaking on the inside.
Yeah. Well, we were freaking because we met some of the girls, women.
They pulled a funny joke on Russell during the sound check for The Bachelor. It was Colton and Cassie's season last season. And they were, you know, setting everything up, and they were doing a rehearsal of the song they were going to play. And so they had them kind of pushed out on those little stages that you can just kind of roll it onto the set. And surprise, surprise, when they started playing their song, the stand-ins for Colton and Cassie, who was it, Russell?
The Amazing Mr. Barnes.
It was so funny.
His lovely wife.
He started singing, and he looked up like, what in the hell are you doing on the Bachelor stage with a rose and dancing? I was Colton's villain. It was funny.
Yeah. Is that when I texted you, by the way? I remember seeing you in the audience.
Yeah. Well, my friend is the... Ken is the director, and so it was just kind of a setup to be fun during
it was
the day.
Cool. I saw you and Heather. I'm like, yeah, I know them.
It was fun. It's fun to go watch that.
So, Russell, you know, you're in a mega group here, Air Supply, and I don't know if you know this or not, but you are a part of a category called Yacht Rock, and Barnes told me you never heard of the term Yacht Rock. I think you mentioned it earlier on the show, right?
Yeah, I've never heard of that before.
That surprises me.
I mean, we've played on a few of them, but I've never had that used as a genre in music.
I'll give you a quick explanation. Yacht rock is a term, it's coined towards adult-oriented rock. And it was music that came out between 1975 and 1984 that had a certain sound. And they call it yacht rock because a lot of the rich people would be on their yachts and cranking up this music because they, you know, were very into it. So I came up with my top 10 yacht rock songs of all time because I happen to be a fan of yacht rock. Right. So I would love to play you some clips, and this is my list. So if you don't like it, sorry. All right. Now
you should make an iHeart playlist, Cubby.
That's right. I'll do that on iHeart Radio. So if you could, guys, I'm going to play these and you chime in on your thoughts. All right. All right. Coming in at number 10, I have Peg by Steely Dan.
I love that song there. I love Steely Dan.
I never knew they were saying Peg.
Yeah, Peg.
Really?
You didn't? Fun.
No.
Great song, by the way.
Awesome.
How long do we have to comment?
You can comment right now. What do you think of that?
Well, it's a great song, but I've had someone babysit my dog some time ago, and I called and I said, can you do Saturday Night? She goes, no, I can't. I'm going to see Steely Dan. And I said, well, you'll be bored shitless. And then she says, Mr. Fagan is my cousin.
Oops.
Oh.
Oops.
So,
ouch.
Foot in mouth.
Shut up, Beavis.
Great song.
I love it. Okay, coming in at number 9 on the Cubby Top 10 Yacht Rock Songs of All Time, I have This Is It by Kenny Loggins. This is it.
Good
good song, right? Come on,
great
Russell.
Song, great song. No, great song. Great voice.
Yeah. Do you ever work with Kenny Loggins?
No. We were supposed to do the Hollywood Bowl with him in September, but they canned the season.
All right. Come in at number eight. I have England Dan and John Ford Coley. Yeah. I'd really love to see you tonight.
I'm not talking about moving in, and I don't want to change your life. But there's a warm wind blowing the stars around, and I'd really love to see you tonight.
I know every word of that song.
Were they a one-hit wonder?
Great harmonies.
I believe they were.
Yeah.
Twitter police will get on us, but I believe they were.
I think I was like 10 when that came out.
Coming in at number 7 on the Cubby Top 10 Yacht Rock Songs of All Time, I have Ambrosia, Biggest Part of Me.
Sunrise. There's a new sun horizon. I can see a new horizon that will keep me realizing.
Thoughts on Ambrosia, Russell?
Another great song. I keep saying that. We actually play 2 or 3 shows a year with those guys, so it's great to hear it.
Apparently, you don't play many with Steely Dan.
No, I don't. I don't think the offer will be forthcoming.
Yeah.
All right, number 6. I have Boss Skaggs and Lowdown.
Put those ideas in your head.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
He's a great guitar player, too.
I got to see Boz last year. His voice still stands. Incredible.
Yep.
Coming in at number 5, I have a song that the Doobie Brothers actually sued over, and I'll explain in a second. It's Robbie Dupree and Steal Away. Do you know this one?
Why don't we steal away? Why don't we steal away into the night?
Sounds a lot like What a Fool Believes, which is coming up on my list, but I got to do some research, but I think the Doobie Brothers ended up suing Robbie Dupree over that.
Wow.
All right. Now, Russell, I love you. I love Air Supply.
Thank you.
But you did not achieve number 1 on my list. I'm sorry, but you did reach number 4.
I'm out of here, man. Sorry, I can't.
No, no. Number 4 is great. Number 4.
I'm all out of love. I'm so lost without you.
How did that song come about?
Graham, we were a period of being very broke in Australia. We'd just toured with Rod Stewart in the US, and we thought we'd be very successful, but we weren't. He went to Adelaide in South Australia, and I went to live with my parents again. And he called me one day, and he said, I think you should come to Adelaide. I wrote a few songs, and so I went to Adelaide. And he'd written All Out of Love, The One That You Love.
A Lot of Love.
And Lost in Love.
That's incredible.
Included, yeah.
You guys were missing a lot of things. You didn't have Air Supply. You're out of love. You, the whole band is missing things.
Well, actually, we're both Geminis. That's an air sign.
Oh, me too. I'm a Gemini, June 1st.
Oh, June 15, man.
Oh, what's up?
Cubby, lastly, a quick funny Russell story for you. That song made me think of it. During coronavirus, we were having these get-togethers still, but outside. And one thing that Russell will never do is sing. So, like, I have a music room in my house with drums, guitars, mics. Dina and I were doing Air Supply on karaoke one night, and we're trying to rope him in. Like, we're in another room. I mean, and he was staying as far away from us as possible.
He doesn't want to karaoke his own songs.
So, enter Cocktails. We were sitting outside, and I was like, "We're I don't know, you're drinking wine, probably." And this has come up multiple times. I will not say, I won't even hum a bar. And after I don't know how many cocktails, he just looked over and goes, "How's this? I'm all out of love." outside, he breaks into song. And we all just looked at him like, "What just happened?" And he just looked at us and goes, "How's that?"
I don't remember that.
I bet you don't.
I bet you don't.
It was about a month ago. Anyway.
All right, guys, I'm almost done. I'm sorry for running late. Number 3 on my top 10 yacht rock songs of all time, I have Rupert Holmes' Escape the Pina Colada.
Good.
If you like pina coladas and getting caught in the rain.
You know, people can make fun of this song all they want, but it was a damn good song.
Yoga, if you have
it's got to be a guilty pleasure for a lot of people.
If you like making love at midnight.
Definitely guilty pleasure for sure.
Yeah, I'm all of those things. I don't care for yoga. I like making love at midnight, and I like pina coladas in the rain. All the things he says.
That's right.
That's a cheese ball song.
Yeah, it's a great guitar lick, though. I like it.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Number two, I mentioned it earlier. I'm putting in the Doobie Brothers, What a Fool Believes. Which sounds like number five.
Wow. Totally.
It sure does.
All right. And the number one song, I wish I had a drum roll, but I don't, on the Cubby Top 10 Yacht Rock Songs of All Time, Christopher Cross and Ride Like the Wind. I always thought Christopher Cross sounded like he was walking away from the mic. He'd be like,
yeah.
What's up? Ride Like the Wind.
Good list, Cubby.
Ride Like the Wind. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed that.
Great number one. He's a very good friend of ours, Christopher. We do shows with him as well.
Please tell me he's a nice guy like you.
Beautiful guy.
The iHeartRadio app. Make that playlist. People will be all over it.
I will.
All right, everybody. Russell, thank you for hanging out with us.
What a pleasure. Great to see you guys, meet you guys. All the best.
So much fun.
You've been amazing, peace, Russell. Thank you.
You are the man.
The Pop Culture Show brought to you by Luna Nuda Prosecco. Cheers from Luna Nuda.